If you were here last week, I said that we wanted to do a couple things before we moved into Acts chapter 9. One of those things was to study the subject of clapping. That is something that has become more and more common in the church, and certainly it's a popular part of the religious realm. I also said after we dealt with the subject of clapping, I wanted to spend some time on the Apostle Paul, because we've been talking about Peter and John, some of the other apostles, and non-Paul stuff, except for the persecution that he was involved with prior to this time. But now we're going to, as we head into Acts chapter 9, shift our attention to Paul. He is introduced in the book of Acts, back there in Acts chapter 7, the end of the chapter, Acts 7 verse 58. You can also see him in Acts chapter 8 verses 1 and 3. But beginning in Acts chapter 9, he becomes a person who has an increasing amount of focus in the book of Acts. One of the first things that we think about Paul is persecution, of course, and Paul. This was a big part of Paul's life. A little bit later when he writes to Timothy, the first letter, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 11 through 13, he talks about the fact that he was a blasphemer, he was a persecutor, he was injurious. There are some things in life that you can do, some good and some bad, that just seem to leave a mark on you for a long time, and that was certainly true of Paul. And a little bit later in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 26 and verse 9, Paul will say there, I thought that I needed to do many things. Not just things, but he said, I thought that I needed to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And he did. I mean, this fella was sort of a one-man destroying team. And you think about the Rangers or the SEALs or some other people who are in special forces. And that was kind of like Paul, but he was looking at this from a religious aspect. You have his persecution described several times in the book of Acts. In addition to that preliminary information in Acts chapter 7 and Acts chapter 8, you're going to see that in Acts chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. And let's just kind of look ahead there just a bit, and then I'll give you a couple more references from Acts. Acts chapter 9, starting there in verse 1. But Saul, yet breathing threatening and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest and asked of him letters of Damascus unto the synagogues, that if he found any that were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. You think the high priest was going to pay attention to just anybody? Think he's just going to waltz into his office and say, well, hey, I'd like to do this and give me authority? Probably not. So if you're going to have that as far as something that is accomplished, you're probably going to have need some kind of backing behind you, whether that's your education or whether that would be political connections. And Paul was, from what we can tell, reasonably well connected. Acts 22 and verse 4, and then a little later in Acts chapter 26 and verse 10, all passages which relate to the persecution that he did. Now we have a lot of conversions in the book of Acts. Can you think of some? All right, we've got the Ethiopian eunuch there in Acts chapter 8. Who else do we have? 3,000. All right, we've got the about 3,000, day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2. Who else? Cornelius. All right, Acts 10, Acts chapter 11, household of Cornelius, the jailer. Acts chapter 16, you've got Lydia and her household in that same chapter. You've got the Corinthians in Acts chapter 18. A lot of people who are converted, and all of those people were significant. But Paul is, as you think about conversions, he's the one that really stands out for a lot of reasons. He certainly, I think we would be willing to say, is probably the most important conversion in the book of Acts. One of the things, and we'll not explore this, but one of the things that makes Paul's conversion so significant is that his life has actually been used to argue for the truthfulness of Christianity. We've talked about before how you can use the Bible to show someone that Scripture is a book that is in a class or category by itself. We've talked about Jesus' resurrection to show the proofs for the resurrection. There are predictive prophecy, a lot of things that you can use. But Paul, when you go back and you start looking at his life, you have someone who is absolutely dedicated. I mean, he is a complete fanatic about this. Not that this would be a perfect parallel, but what about the fellow who is into something like racing? I mean, racing is his life. He goes to the races, he collects race cars, he gets racing magazines, his house is all decked out in racing, and that is his life. I mean, he wanted to build a race car and had a special barn for it, and that's where he spends all of his money. And then one day, nothing in his house is about racing. He's taken down the barn, sold the cars, got rid of everything, doesn't want to talk about racing. What would be going through your mind?
There's a change of some kind.
Yeah, and not just a change, but what kind of change? You have radically changed. You have drastically changed. And when you see that kind of drastic or dramatic change in a person's life, the question becomes why? You were so fanatical about this. And Paul, he just took that to the nth degree, as we read from Acts chapter 9. He's not just persecuting Christians, but I mean, he's going to the high priest. And he says, I want letters of authority to go several miles down the road, so to speak, and to have the authority, to have the right to persecute Christians. So his conversion has actually been used to help establish the truthfulness of Christianity. You just don't go from this extreme, and he was, when you think about extreme, when it comes to persecution, he was at the top. You just don't go from that to the very opposite. I mean, it would be one guy to go back to the racing illustration. It would be one thing to say, I'm going to sell all my racing stuff, and that sometimes happens. But for that to be parallel to the Apostle Paul, what would that guy need to do? Here was the guy, he was the biggest proponent, he was the biggest fan of a certain kind of racing. What's the complete opposite extreme of that? Not just get rid of your stuff.
Anti-racing.
Now you're anti-racing. You do everything that you can to erase racing from your national culture. And for us, that would be almost unbelievable. We can understand if he sort of stops in the middle and says, I don't want anything to do with it. We're curious about that. Explain that to us. But if you're going all the way to the end where now you're going to oppose that with every fiber of your being, people say that just makes no sense whatsoever. There's got to be something behind that. And that's really what you see with Paul. And it's a very compelling story.
He's not getting rid of that Jewish background. But he's saying it's been completed, it's fulfilled, and it's no longer binding.
Yeah. And that's why I say with the racing illustration, you just flip to the complete opposite. And it's, how can you do that? Why? That it? Okay, let's go back and look at some other things. You have, as you look at the book of Acts, his conversion mentioned three times. First time in Acts chapter 9, second time Acts chapter 22, third time is going to be in Acts chapter 26. And more than half the book, Acts 13 chapters 13 to 28, will be about Paul's evangelistic efforts. We know where he was born, right? Acts chapter 22 and verse 3, he was born in the city of... Starts with T, ends with S. He was born in the city of Tarsus, and he was also from which tribe? Anybody recall? Tribe of Benjamin. Now, we don't talk about the tribes too often, but let's pick up a couple details about Benjamin. Now, when you think about this, we'll head somebody back to Genesis 49:27, and also somebody over to Judges chapter 20. Genesis 49:27, you have a minute to get there. Who wants it? Brian? Genesis 49:27, from the book of Judges, chapter 20, verses 12 to 16. Judges 20, 12 to 16. All right, that'll be Jenny. Now, when you think about people, for example, you say, well, somebody's from down south. What might you associate with that? All right, now that's not true of everybody necessarily, but generally speaking, you would think that's going to typify people from down south. People from up north, you would say, well, you're from up north because you do what? All right, you go ice fishing, so you're probably not from Florida. But there are certain things northeast, from the west coast, the east coast, or certain activities where we say, okay. Now, bearing that in mind, we're going to start with Genesis chapter 49 and verse 27.
Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning you shall devour the prey, and at night you shall divide the spoil.
All right, now that sort of sets the stage for the tribe of Benjamin. What's suggested there as far as a ravenous wolf? All right, aggressiveness, fierceness, anything else? What about persistence and dedication? Uh-huh. Now, again, that may not be true of every single person, but at least that kind of sets the stage for what we find a little bit later. Let's take a look at Judges chapter 20, verses 12 to 16.
Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin.
There it is. I'm going to let you continue to read, but the tribe of Benjamin, all right?
The children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all these people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Every one could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No. How far are you?
That's good. Thank you very much. All right, 4 points there. Number one, were they willing to listen?
No.
They would not listen. Number two, the Bible, the translation that she read from did a great job. Thank you. Instead, people are going this way. We're willing to go the contrary way. Battle, third word that sticks out. And then how many of them? Bible says every one. And these people were from that kind of spirit, a warlike, fierce, very dedicated kind of spirit. Now, again, that doesn't mean that just because you're the tribe of Benjamin, that's necessarily going to be what you're like. But back there in Genesis, it sort of sets the stage. And when you begin to look at the life of Paul, he lived up to what you find as far as indications from the tribe of Benjamin. Now, you have sometimes, we talk about a person who is born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Everything seems to just line up. They are from the right family. They're from the right time. Everything falls into place. And that's sort of what you find with the Apostle Paul. When you look at Saul's place of birth where he was reared, Tarsus, that was what you might say was a power center of Greek learning in that day and time. It rivaled Athens and Alexandria. You think about the fellow who is raised in the country, goes to a little country school, and he might have a really good teacher. But chances are, if you're out there in the country school, you're not going to get what you might get as far as a private education in a big city. They've got all the money and all the teachers and all the things. So you might be less bright, but you still might fare a whole lot better because you had the extra opportunities compared to this fellow who's super smart. He's out there in the country school, and he sort of lives a country bumpkin kind of life. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but his opportunities are more limited. So Paul's coming from a place which is really significant in the first century. Tarsus, you have a lot of Greek influence there. Greek philosophy would have been commonly taught. And it's just like today. If you are out there in the country school and you are given a reasonably good education, but then you're thrust out into a place like New York, New York City, you're probably going to feel a little bit out of place. I mean, you just didn't grow up with that kind of thing. But Paul is in this special place, and for what he did as far as preaching the gospel later, it put him into the right place. Then you begin to see some of this when you look at a couple of passages in the New Testament. Remember over there in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 17 and verse 28. Paul said, for even some of your own poets, remember that? Even some of your own poets have said. Now, if you're out there in the country school, you might not get much of that education. But if you're over here being trained, being schooled in a place where they have, a lot of culture teachers and a lot of extra material and so forth. And then Titus chapter 1 and verse 12, you have the same kind of thing there. Paul's going over and he's pulling from some resources that would have been familiar to those people in his day and time. And those passages indicate that he did receive some training from a Greek background. That's also important too, because when you look at the New Testament, the books were written in what language?
Greek.
So if you're going to write about half of the New Testament, you probably want to know the language. Now, God could have certainly overcome that, but that training in Greek thought, in Greek background, certainly would have been very, very familiar. You also begin to see that when you start looking at some of the imagery in the New Testament. You start thinking about some of what Paul wrote. The Corinthian correspondence, for example, he talks about racing. He talks about boxing. When you think about the letters to Timothy, there is military analogies in there. You've got figures of buildings and builders, and you've got debtors, and you've got slaves. All those things come from the Greek world. And if you're trying to communicate with people in a certain area, for example, there have been people who were interested in working in a college town, preachers, and they maybe spent a lot of their time as far as studies in the academic realm, and they think like someone that you would find in a college town, and they're interested in those kinds of things, and they're just a natural fit. But you have sometimes some of the people, and then you have some congregations, they say, we're a country congregation. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you've got the PhD and some postdoctoral work, you know, chances are that the country congregation just may not be the right fit for you. It might be that you're going to fit in a whole lot better. And Paul, as you look at his life, I mean, he's bouncing around here, there, and everywhere. And do you remember what he said to the Corinthians? I'm become how many things? I've become all things to all men that I may save some. If you're going to be that well-rounded, where you can deal with people of almost any culture, any background, you're going to need a lot of experience. So coming from Tarsus, the city of Greek learning and Greek culture, it was very, very helpful. But on the flip side of it, not everybody was going to be a Greek, right? You're also going to have some people who were going to be Jews. So if you're going to make some inroads with the Jews, you also need to have some kind of pedigree. You need to have some connection to the Jewish people. And that's what we find as well. In fact, Paul not only was someone who came from a Jewish background. Remember, we should know this. Acts chapter 22 and verse 3, I think, is a reference. He sat at the feet of what famed Jewish teacher? We saw him earlier in the book of Acts, at the feet of Gamaliel. And remember, we talked about the fact there were about 7 rabbis that the Jews, I mean, just held up in the highest esteem. I mean, it was like having Moses across from you. And Gamaliel was one of those guys. So it's like today, you're talking with somebody and a person says, well, where have you worked? Or where did you go to school? Or where have you lived? They're trying to make a connection. And you can imagine that if people came, you know, Paul goes into the synagogue and they would say, well, okay, you know, fellow Jew, we're glad that you're here. And hey, by the way, where'd you grow up? Tarsus. Oh, wow, that's impressive. And where'd you go to school? Did you have any rabbinical training? Gamaliel? Come on up. Give us a lesson today. I mean, that surely opened some doors for this fella as he was, again, sort of hobnobbing around the world. And God put it to use as far as an apostle. Now, you start looking. Anything that you want to add or ask before I say a couple more things? Glenda?
What was Genesis scripture that you started?
Genesis 49 and verse 7, I believe. 49 or 20, 27. 49, 27. Okay. Paul is sometimes referred to as an apostle to the Gentiles. You see that in places like the book of Galatians, Galatians chapter 2 and verse 8, also in the book of Ephesians, Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 8. Now that becomes maybe significant when you look at the book of Acts. His conversion is first mentioned where? Acts chapter 9. And then in that next chapter of Acts, Acts chapter 10, what do you have? The conversion of Cornelius. And he was a Jew or a Gentile? He was a Gentile. So maybe Luke is trying to make that connection as well, sort of play off a little bit as far as Paul being a primarily an apostle to the Gentiles. But Paul was not the only one who reached out to the Gentiles, but a lot of his work among the Gentiles was especially noteworthy. As you look at Acts chapter 9 and verse 15, this is God's assessment of Paul. But the Lord said unto him, that would be Ananias, go thy way, for he is what kind of vessel? He is a chosen vessel unto me. God can use anybody. But as God looked at Paul, he knew that this fella had some things that could be especially useful to the cause of Christ. And some of those items are items that we just discussed as far as the Greek background and also the Jewish background. When you think about Paul, after he became a Christian, he was an ex-Pharisee. He was the fellow who had once hated and hounded Christians. He knew what it was like to be on the other side of the fence. If somebody didn't like a Christian, Paul could say, I know what you're thinking. I was this guy who got letters from the high priest authority from the Sanhedrin to go and to persecute Christians. We also, as we think about him, he made those 3 missionary journeys that we'll talk about a little later in the book of Acts. He was someone who literally helped establish dozens of local congregations. He was the most vicious wolf surely that the church has ever seen, and yet, even though he doesn't fit the mold, he became very, very effective. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 8, we'll also look at this. The sermon this morning in the AM happens to be about the word apostle. I didn't intend that. That was just the way that things worked out. But he says, I was like a child who was born out of season, born at an untimely time. It just didn't seem to him like he was going to be someone who would ever fit the mold, so to speak. And then in that next verse, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 9, he says this, for I am the least of the apostles and am not meet to be called an apostle. Then he gives a reason, because I persecuted the church of God. When you look at Paul, you find someone who in other times and circumstances might have been someone who would have had a big problem with pride. And Paul makes the point. He said, I did receive that thorn in the flesh to make sure that I didn't, you know, exalt myself above what needed to be. But you find that he was someone who was maybe a bit introverted, someone who was certainly willing to recognize his role in the church, but at the same time always maintain a good balance of humility. When he talked to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 1, he uses some language there which Paul says, look, I'm going to have to talk about myself a little bit, but I'm not really comfortable doing that. I mean, I know that to make the point, you've got to know some things about me, but you know, that's that just really makes me uncomfortable. So again, a very humble man, even though if you want to be someone who is able to boast, I mean, Paul could have. From his Greek education, his Jewish education, all the things that he did as a Christian, the things that he overcame in life. I mean, he really was a spectacular fella. And again, God said in Acts chapter 9, he is a chosen vessel. Paul's usefulness as far as the gospel is concerned is illustrated by at least facts. Number one, he knew the Jewish culture well. We have that problem today, don't we? Let's look at it from a secular standpoint. If you are the president, or you are maybe a senator, or maybe you are a high-ranking person in a business, and you're going to meet someone on foreign soil. You're going to go to Japan, or you're going to go to India. Do you think that there may be some cultural problems that you face if you just get off the plane and, you know, start doing your American stuff? Yeah. You know, you're maybe going to blow the business deal. Maybe you can't get the agreement that needs to be made. And when you start looking at people like presidents, now we've got Google that can help a little bit. But when you start looking at people who are interacting with others, anybody who has a lick of sense will realize there may be some cultural differences that we need to understand before we start going and talking to people or working with people. And that just makes sense. We have the same problem today, don't we, as far as different personalities? Have you ever met somebody, you talked to somebody, or tried to engage somebody in a conversation, and you just didn't click? And you thought, wow, you know, I just can't communicate with that person. Well, were they from a different planet? No, but they had a personality which was so different to you, a personality maybe that you were unfamiliar with, that had you understood that personality a little bit better, had your personality been a different type, there may have been a better bond, maybe an instant bond, maybe a really close bond, because you just were not on the same wavelength. So we have that problem at different levels. If Paul was going to work among the Jewish people, he had to be coming from the same playing field. And in some respects, if he had that Jewish background with Gamaliel, that helped as well. So he makes that point in Acts chapter 21 and verse 40, also in Philippians chapter 3. I mean, I was a Jew through and through. And he knew the Jewish theology, Galatians chapter 1 and verse 14. All right, then we go back and we talked about what came from Genesis 49 and verse 27 earlier. That is, he was from Jewish theology. And again, the book of Galatians talks about that a bit. He was from Benjamin. That would have been one of the two tribes that stayed in the south during the time of the split. And he says, I was a Hebrew of the Hebrews. In other words, if you want to look at someone and say, how Jewish are you? Paul said, just through the roof. I had it all. The pedigree was there. There was nothing about my Jewish roots which could be questioned. We mentioned the fact that he came from Tarsus. He also possessed the privileges of a Roman citizen. Again, for us, that makes sense a little bit. When you start, I don't know that this is true for sure, but I think that even if you are questioned by the CIA or you're charged with another serious crime, you still have the right to ask for a lawyer. Now, that's a pretty nice right. If you are in a foreign country and they grab you, guess what? Don't expect much as far as rights. But we have, because we are an American citizen, some very special rights. I mean, they pick you up, and what do they say? You have the right. You know, you don't have to answer our questions. We don't have the right to take the nightstick or the flashlight and start beating you until you confess. Now, we might take you to jail, and you might spend some time in jail, but you can stay absolutely silent. And it's kind of amazing to me that a lot of people hear that and it just seems to go over the head and they just start rattling off and get themselves into a lot of trouble. But people do have the right to shut up. And that's a great right. Well, if you were a Roman citizen, did you have some rights? Yeah, they couldn't beat you, among some other things. And you had some special freedoms. So if God is going to have someone who is going to preach the gospel, get someone who's from a Jewish background, get someone who has all those things in place as far as a pedigree. Get someone from a tribe who is very dedicated, who's very persistent, who has almost a warlike personality. And then get someone who's also from a Greek background, been trained very, very well. Someone who has the privileges of a Roman citizen. They have the maximum number of privileges for that day and time. And let's get him on board and let's give him a reputation. Well, he got that, obviously, very early. And let's get him out preaching the gospel. So when God says in Acts chapter 9, this guy is a chosen vessel, that was exactly right. All right, then, if that wasn't enough, what about this special vessel? He's out there preaching. Again, he's going to have some problems at various times. Might it be helpful if the guy has a trade? Yeah, because there might be, you know, he's out, you know, we don't exactly have PayPal in the first century, do we? There's no, we can telegraph you some money. There's no credit card. So if he needs some money, he's probably going to have to engage in some kind of activity. Well, what do you think would have been a good activity in that day and time? Yeah, if you can work with cloth, I mean, that was one of the things that people needed. It would be like some trades today where people say this is, you're sort of, if you can do some things with electricity, you can do some things with plumbing. There are a lot of places that you can work. And Paul had that trade where he was able to support himself in secular employment. You see that in the book of Acts chapter 18 and verse 3. You also find that in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 verses 4 through 8. So he's got leadership qualities, this zeal, this theological insight. And then if that's not enough, in Romans chapter 15 and verse 20, Paul said, I have this desire to take the gospel where it's never gone before. I mean, this guy is the total package, isn't he? I mean, he's got it all. And then he says, I'm willing to go where, it's kind of Star Trek, going where no man has gone before. You remember those words? Well, that's kind of what Paul's philosophy was as far as a missionary. I'm willing to work in places where nobody has ever gone before. Now, that is something that is not common in a lot of people. It freaks some people out to think that they're going to have to pull up stakes and maybe move 50 miles away, 100 miles away, find a new job, find a new house, and start all over. I mean, that happens sometimes, perhaps because there was some kind of great disaster. But that's scary. But trying to start a congregation from scratch. Now, if you're a missionary, you've got some support intact, you're moving to another country, hopefully you've got another family or two with you, still, that's difficult. But even in this country, thinking about going out and trying to start a new congregation, well, let's meet at the house or let's run a school, those kinds of things, it is a challenge. Anything you want to add or ask before we look at some of the writings? Stan?
To me, one of the most striking things, and you mentioned it about Paul, was the fact that he had all of these privileges. He had all of this education, which is fine. You like to have someone, if you're going to learn from them, to have that kind of a background, but it also tends to take, for people who are working class people, and put somebody like that on a different level, and in some cases, actually, they shy away from it. To me, the telling point about Paul was that he was a tent maker. Even though he had all of those privileges and he had that background, he was still willing to and evidently came from an economic level that people, the common people, would relate to him. So he could go into Athens and speak to those who were high and mighty in the intelligentsia, but he could also go down to the river and speak to the women who probably didn't have much of anything.
Yeah. You wonder if he didn't sort of come up from the ranks. I mean, there have been some parents who have been middle-class parents. They didn't have a lot of money, but they sacrificed a lot to send their kids to school, maybe worked a second job. Maybe the person who was going to school also worked. So we don't know exactly what Paul's circumstances were, but it's very possible that he came from a quote-unquote average family, but he had that fierce, warlike, dedicated spirit where I'm going to work tooth and nail. And maybe mom and dad helped out a lot as well. So you do see, I think, more indications that he was coming from that level of society rather than the high and mighty. And again, as you said, as you rightly said, he's able to communicate with people of all levels. Once again, he's a chosen vessel in part for that reason. Anybody else? Okay, some other things that we want to go ahead and make sure that we look at before we dig into Acts chapter 9. We don't know how long Paul's conversion came after the start of the church in Acts chapter 2? That's a question that I really like to know. The best estimates, I think, are probably about 4 years. If that's about right, that to me would make a lot of sense. You know, 4 years, we use that time, for example, for a military enlistment sometimes. You're in there for 4 years. That gives you enough time for a good platform, a good base to be established, and then maybe you're going to do this, you're going to do that. So I think that's about reasonable. 4 or 5 years, and then you've got perhaps another 4 or 5 years. You have Gentiles coming into the church. That would be in Acts chapter 9 and Acts chapter 10. And Paul is probably going to be, in my estimate, probably in his 30s, about the time that he's converted. One reason for saying that is at the end of Acts chapter 7. In Acts chapter 7, verse 8, and the Bible says, and they cast him out of the city and stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their garments at the feet of a, what kind of man? Of a young man whose name was Saul. So again, you know, 40 and up, that doesn't seem to fit as far as Jewish thought, young. 20s, when you look at where Saul was, that doesn't seem to be right either. So I'm thinking that he was probably in his 30s when he was converted. So again, nice platform. The chosen vessel also, I think, probably includes where he was as far as his time in life. So we do know from the book of Galatians that Paul goes away for 3 years. Now that seems like a lot of time, but remember, when he's going to do all the things that need to be done, it's like the had a work day yesterday in the subdivision and had a couple guys out there with chainsaws, and we were trying to take down some trees and whatnot. So one guy finally sent his son home. He said, look, my saw is not cutting very well. You go home and get the file. And after he filed on the blade for a little while, we fared a lot better as far as taking some of the trees down. But sometimes you just need to come out of the woods for a little bit and sharpen the axe or sharpen the chainsaw. And that seems to be what that three-year period in Arabia was. Paul is trying to connect the dots as far as some information and be better prepared for the work that he was going to do. Within 5 years of his conversion, again, that's an estimate. I think it's a good estimate. He probably is going to head on his first missionary journey there to the area of Galatia. And a time in that, again, we have to be approximate, but maybe between 45 to 48 A.D., and when you think about the transportation in that day and time, you don't have any cars, no buses. You are able to travel by ship sometimes, and he did do that. But if you're going to not walk or travel by ship, you've got animals such as donkeys, horses, and camels, and he traveled a lot of miles on some things that probably were not all that comfortable. Then maybe within a year or two of that first journey, he takes another missionary journey. Again, trying to figure out, that could have been, you know, around AD 49 to 53 AD. Third journey, again, probably within within a year of the second journey, again, probably around 54 AD, and probably last till about AD 57. He then is imprisoned, taken a prisoner to Rome, suffered shipwreck, writes some final letters of prison epistles such as Ephesians, Colossians, and then gets to the end of his life. We don't know exactly what happened to him. Most believe that he was probably executed by Nero. So when you look at this guy, he had a really, really full life. When you think about some of the things that he experienced, again, we talked about Acts chapter 9, the authority from the Sanhedrin, the high priest. It's not long after his conversion. We'll see this in Acts chapter 9. His life is under threat. There's some people who want to kill him. You know, you would think, well, I've given all this up for Christ, and, you know, he's going to take good care of me. And one of the first things that you find in your life as a Christian is people want to kill you. I might have had a little bit of a faith crisis at that point, thinking, you know, is this really the right decision? But he had the experience on the road, and you may remember that he's let down through the hole in the city wall. There's the basket experience, and that would have been exciting. I think that probably would have been enough for us, at least for a period of time. But when you look at Paul, there were several of the things that took place. A little later in Acts chapter 9, he goes to the assembly of Christians in Jerusalem, and is he, Acts 9:26, well-received or not well-received? They don't want anything to do with him. So again, you have to think about that. You know, I barely escaped, and now I'm trying to come and be with brethren, and they don't want to have anything to do with me. Carol?
Well, in verse 16, I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. God talking to Ananias. But Paul had been doing the persecuting, so he should have a good idea what might be in store for him.
Yeah. Yeah, once he started to process that, and again, I think the 3 years in Arabia may have been helpful in some of that regard to really reflect on things, and maybe that's why that impressed on him so deeply, the damage that he'd done. But yeah, I mean, he really has his life turned inside out and upside down. He...
The 3 years also, the other apostles were with Christ for 3 years, so apostles could have while they were with Jesus.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, that's a great point to bring out, that they needed some time to sort things out. Now, again, Paul sort of... Yeah, it's kind of flipped around a little bit. The apostles need 3 years to figure it out, and then bang. Paul figures it out, but then he's got to kind of go in reverse. And again, I think maybe that's part of the 1 Corinthians 15:8 and 9, that I was born out of due season. Things really got mixed up and turned around. But whether you're doing it A to Z or Z to A, God can make it work either way. But that was a lot for him to process. And if he was really going to do the job, he needed to have that right foundation intact. So yes, thoughtful point. Stan?
Well, in the secular world, you take someone who is well on his way to becoming an alcoholic, spends all of his time in the bars around some pretty rough people, some people who are on the same path he is, and then all of a sudden he is converted, and in some way or another, he has determined that is the wrong way to go and turns around and tries to convince others then that that's the wrong way to go. He's going to be really persecuted by those who were his friends.
Yeah. And that 3-year period may have also been a little bit of a buffer.
Yeah.
I mean, information gets out about Paul. You've already got what we have in Acts chapter 9. They're concerned about him to the point where, you know, pretty much just shut the doors. We don't want anything to do with you. So, again, there had to be several things there that needed to be sorted out within a period of about 36 months, and some things can only be processed so quickly. In the secular world, I thought this is where you were going to go. You didn't, but a journeyman, an apprentice, again, the same kind of thing. Before you are at the full level or you are here at the top tier of this particular work field, there's a process that you need to go through. When we think about Paul, there's some other things. A little bit later next, this is over in Acts chapter 11, you're going to read about a famine. And it was a bad famine, and Paul is involved with that to the point of helping get some money to the Christians in Jerusalem. And again, you have to look at that, and you have to think, you got this guy showing up on your doorstep with some cash, a lot of money, and you really need the money, but you're kind of thinking, from you? And even from Paul's standpoint, can you imagine maybe going back and having to face some of the people that did not want to receive you back there in Acts chapter 9 and verse 26? I think there's a great lesson there. Sometimes people can say, well, we don't want to go back and see those people again. You ever find that true in a local congregation? Person has had an experience, we don't want to go back and see him. Well, Paul could have had that experience, but again, it speaks so well of him where he was willing to not only go back, but he's the one that wants to carry the money, or help carry the money. Do you think that he could have found somebody else and said, well, I don't want to go back and see him, find somebody else? Sure, but he didn't do that. All right, you have some other things too. You find over in Acts chapter 15, he's got this disagreement, remember, over John Mark? You know, and the Bible says it was a sharp contention, so he knew what it was like to have a disagreement with fellow Christians. You have him visiting all kinds of places, southern Galatia, Asia Minor, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Achaia. I've got him in the area of Athens, Corinth. He's someone who experienced house arrest, Acts chapter 28, verses 30 and 31. You can talk to people. We had... new preachers show up at the last preacher's meeting. Ray was down there. We talked to him for a little bit. He said, I've been around the world 7 times. Now, I'll probably, if I wanted to compete with him, which I don't, but if I wanted to compete with him, I'll probably never be able to compete in that sense. I doubt that I'll get around the world once, let alone 7 times. He said, I slept on Mount Sinai twice. Now, I wouldn't mind doing that at least once, I think. But again, there's some people you can talk to, and the experiences that they've had in life, you have to sit back and say, wow. You know, I will never probably have anything in my life that's going to come close to that. And if you could sit down and talk to Paul and say, tell me about all the things, I mean, it would be just like, well, let's just write a series of books. I mean, here's volume 1 and volume 2 and volume 3. This fella, not only the background that he had, but as he continued to experience things in life, it was amazing. And then, you remember over there in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 to 28, Paul said, of the Jews, 5 times I was... a night and a day in the deep, and you know, I was in danger from these people and these people and these people. Paul, his life is like a treasure trove of facts and details and things that a Christian can experience. I mean, he really is a fascinating character, and then when you consider he wrote about half the New Testament, it's really good to have a good understanding of it. When you look at Paul, we do find some practical lessons from his life. Number one, we think about and talk about from time to time about trusting in the things of this life, trusting in the arm of flesh. Could Paul have done that? had the education, had the background, had the connections. But he said in Philippians chapter 3, I did what? He said, I counted it all as loss, refuge, willing to just shove it all down the drain. Well, God wasn't willing to quite do that because, again, he was a chosen vessel. But Paul shows us that whatever the accomplishments, whatever the blessings that we are in life, remember that that's not really what counts. He also illustrates Romans chapter 10, verses 1 through 3. Paul said the Jews were able to have a zeal for God, but that zeal was not according to knowledge. You can find some people who have a strong passion for God. They love God. They talk about God. They think they're serving God, but they're misdirected. That was Paul in a nutshell. And as he looks at the Jews there in Romans chapter 10, you can maybe almost see himself as he's talking about those people. I was there in some respects where you are now. And he wanted them to get out of that. All right. What about God being able to use anybody? You think that's true? I mean, if God was able to take the foremost persecutor of the church and turn him around, God can use almost anybody. Occasionally, we'll find someone who says, well, I've done all these bad things. God can't save me. God can't forgive me. What's Exhibit A when we talk to someone like that? All right. He was the chief of sinners. Remember that from 1 Timothy chapter 1? If God can save the chief, then guess what? He can take care of you. So Paul is helpful on an ongoing basis for that reason. What about someone who says, well, I have nothing to contribute to the cause of Christ? Can we also use Paul to help that person? Yeah. I mean, no one is going to be in a position where they're worthless. I mean, you could say, well, Paul, he had all these things, but he had done so much damage. Things can be turned around. What about a bad past? Person says, I've had a bad past. I've had a horrible past. You can't understand all the things in my past. And that probably would be true for Paul. Even though you have a bad past, does that mean that your service in God's kingdom needs to be limited? No. Yeah. And I think that is going to be true when you look at Paul. This seems to have, all that zeal he had, that just seems to have ramped that up to the point where he is on maximum potential, maximum energy. So today when someone comes along and says, well, you know, it's just not going to work for me. A bad past does not matter. Now, might a bad past have some impact on what we do? If you've got a person who has been convicted of theft on multiple occasions, do you think you want to appoint him treasurer? Okay, that's probably not going to be the spot where you want to put him. So there may be some things that you don't specifically do, but isn't that true for every Christian? Not every Christian is qualified, or not every Christian should be asked to do everything. So again, a person says, well, I couldn't be that. Well, that's true. But I'm also not qualified, or I'm not in a position to do this either. So we're on the same playing field. When you think about Paul, is he a good example for contentedness? He found contentment. Yes. And there were a lot of things that he could have complained about, whined about, and moaned about, and been unhappy about in life. But he found contentment in his life. Would you say that he is an example of spiritual growth? I mean, when you take somebody who's all the way over here, and he comes all the way over here, he found it. And that's something that will be helpful for us as well. What about unwavering commitment? Do you see that in Paul? We can also point out that staying focused on the Lord and being mindful of what people say, even though it may not be well received, is what is still right. Galatians 4:16, Paul said, have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? We always want to make sure that we're trying to help people but not be people pleasers. We remember that our life is not our own. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, Paul said, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, it's not my life, it's Christ who's living in me. We need to remember that we're not going to be perfect. Paul was certainly not. Such was true for the other apostles. But Paul said, I do want to live my life and be as offense-free as possible. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 3. A couple of the quick points. He said, I don't want to disqualify myself. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27, want to make sure that after I've preached to others, I'm not rejected. Try to live a life which can be imitated by others. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11 verse 1, imitate me as I imitate Christ. And then finally, expect to suffer for Christ. Remember 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, yea, all that would live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution.